You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
If you make a hobby of cataloging errors and fallacies that shaped history, what a weird hobby, you weirdo. There are certain names that start to pop up over and over again. Perhaps you've noticed names like Galen, Empedocles, Athanasius Kircher, and, say it with me now, fucking Aristotle. But what about Georges-Louis Leclerc, the Comte de Buffon? Where's his parade? Where's his t-shirt? Buffon has come up in this show at least six separate times, but I fear he's never made quite the impression he deserves. He was the first guy to take a daring stab at dating the age of the Earth. He figured that the planet had started out as a molten rock, good, and that it had then cooled at a steady rate, bad. So he heated a cannonball, spun it around, measured how long it took to cool to normal Earth temperature, and extrapolated from there. Pretty flawed all the way around, and even Buffon seemed disappointed in his results. They indicated that the Earth was around 75,000 years old, but his heart was at least in the right place. Buffon's theory was known as catastrophism. It accounted for geological features like mountains, gorges, valleys, and oceans by saying that as the Earth cooled, certain places would suddenly buckle, rumble, bend, and burst, so that even features as large as Mount Everest or as deep as the Grand Canyon were formed in a matter of days. Bad. Although at least catastrophism allowed for the possibility of the planet changing over time, which was in contrast to the then prevailing idea that everything was exactly as it had always been. He was one of the loudest and most effective defenders of the classification of whales as fish. Bad. He was one of the loudest and most effective deniers that apes were people. Is that good? Bad? I'm not sure! His theory on race, though, is pretty clear-cut. In contrast to some naturalists of his time, Buffon believed that all peoples were descended from a set of common ancestors. I'm not saying good yet, because hold on. A literal Adam and Eve, who were, very importantly, white. All other races were degradations of white people, sullied by sunny climates and tropical diets. He felt that, with the proper guidance, control, and herding, all of humanity could be re-whitened. And wouldn't that be swell for everyone? Bad. In more ways than one, Georges-Louis Leclerc, the Comte de Buffon, was the perfect exemplification of 18th century science. He made all these attempts at geology, cosmology, and even evolutionary theory, which paved the way for great discoveries to come, but which mostly fell on their faces in the moment. He helped spread Enlightenment ideas, even while laying the groundwork for all kinds of racism, colonialism, and ecological devastation. And his career echoed that of some of his greatest forebearers, like Copernicus and Galileo, his noodling on what Charles Darwin would eventually expand into natural selection and into an age of the Earth older than the widely accepted 6,000 years put him in conflict with the Bible, and he was forced to recant both. Without his singular achievements, as complicated and flawed as many of them were, the whole organ of science may have been stymied and stifled. So, this time around, I am going to make you remember Georges-Louis Leclerc, the Comte de Buffon. Not for any of that stuff. Not for anything he wrote or thought or did. Instead, I want you to think of Buffon for what he had. kidney stones. For roughly the last 20 years of his life, Buffon was seized by sharp pain in his back and abdomen. It hurt to pee, and sometimes his urine ran red with blood. The pain made him nauseous, made him vomit, made his life just fucking miserable. Some people with kidney stone disease end up passing the stones, a not at all pleasant process frequently likened to childbirth. But Buffon's lot was worse. He did not pass them. The stones collected inside his urinary tract, one upon another. When he died in 1788, his autopsy revealed a total of 57 stones inside him. I know, it is pleasant to imagine. But as far as Georges-Louis Leclerc was concerned, there was one thing worse than having 57 stones in his urinary tract. Having 57 stones removed from his urinary tract. Lithotomy, meaning stone cut, is an ancient surgical procedure. It's described in the Sushruta Samhita, a Sanskrit book on medicine dating from around 600 BC. Hippocrates included a special section of his oath about kidney stones, with doctors promising not to perform the procedure themselves, but to leave it to the specialists. In the 1700s and 1800s, that advice was still followed. You might suffer a mediocre wheelwright or a subpar butcher. Bad lawyers abounded, and fumbling doctors prospered. But when it came to lithotomists, only the best would do. Because a good, experienced lithotomist might be able to perform the procedure in a minute. If things went badly, it could take hours. In 1824, a doctor who preferred to remain anonymous wrote into the Lancet to describe the terrible state of surgical science, particularly vis-a-vis a lithotomy he had recently witnessed being performed on a young boy. The lead surgeon had inserted a urethral sound into the boy's bladder. Quote, "Unfortunately, he could not feel the stone, till after trying in all directions and putting the boy in excruciating pain for several minutes, he at last satisfied himself and gave the instrument into the hand of another surgeon for another testimony. This second surgeon could not find the stone also, so he passed off the task to a third. These examinations occupied a full 20 minutes, the nameless doctor wrote, during the whole of which time the boy continued screaming and was nearly exhausted before the operation commenced. The author described being a surgical patient the way many others did. It was like serving a prison sentence, knowing your turn with the torturer awaited. For Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, 20 years spent suffering the harms of several dozen kidney stones was better than even a minute under the knife. And he was not alone. People had been performing surgeries for thousands of years, mostly setting broken bones or drilling holes in skulls, that's for another time, cutting away tumors or amputating limbs. Caesarean sections were conducted rarely, as far back as, well, Caesar, and even longer ago in China, but caesareans remained a last resort into the 19th century for two reasons. One, the mortality rates on caesareans were shockingly high. It was practically a death sentence. But they were also the last resort for the same reason all surgeries were seen as a last resort. There was nothing to be done about the pain. Pain. More than infection, or rejection, or the intricacies of the vascular system, or any other factor, was the biggest problem in all of medicine. And the greatest roadblock in the human quest to treat and cure both injury and illness. And for millennia, we had no suitable champion to challenge it. Pain ruled over mankind with a harsher hand than death itself. And while many people dreamed or endeavored to vanquish the Reaper, the towering omnipresence of pain was so oppressive that few could even imagine a world where it could be diluted, let alone avoided. Humanity was so ensconced in pain for so long that no one could envision a solution, even though the solution had been sitting right in front of their faces for centuries. And then, one day, one very particular day, that all changed. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Welcome to our three-part series on the history of anesthesia. This episode, we are looking at how pain dominated medicine. On the next part, we will look at how medicine came to dominate pain. And finally, we will look at the messy, freaky story of the fight over who to credit for that most profound of reversals. Today's episode, Comfortably Numb, Part 1. If you're trying to eat better, Factor can make it easier with delicious, fresh, never-frozen, ready-to-eat meals that are ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, and there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. I will tell you, with a newborn in the house, Factor has been a real godsend. When you don't want to cook, but you still want to eat healthy without breaking the bank, it's a fantastic option. The meals are ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes with no prep, no mess, no cooking, no cleanup. It's less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. And you can get as many or as few Factor meals as you want every week and pause or reschedule deliveries anytime. They've got great breakfast, lunch, and snack options as well, like pancakes, smoothies, and specific dietary options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Go check them out. Head to factormeals.com/constant50 and use code CONSTANT50 to get 50% off. That's code CONSTANT50 at factormeals.com/constant50 to get 50% off.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1819, a nightingale made its nest near Wentworth Place in Hampstead, the home of John Keats, inspiring him to write an ode to the bird, which has since become one of the most republished and repeated poems of the Romantic period. It begins, "My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past, and lethwards had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that though, like winged dryad of the trees in some melodious plot, of beechen green and shallows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease." The connection between Keats' ode to a nightingale and the topic at hand isn't the one you're likely to draw. While opium, hemlock, and alcohol were all leaned on for the treatment of pain both pre- and post-surgery, they were not good enough to do the trick. They're analgesics, pain softeners, not anesthetics. Better than nothing, you might say, but that wasn't necessarily true. In the wrong quantities, all the known analgesic drugs might be fatal, and getting quantities right wasn't something anybody had ever really bothered to figure out. opiates are highly addictive. So is alcohol, of course. But opioid addiction was acute and rare enough that people actually noticed. Still, surgical patients did take all of these drugs, and many others, usually on their own without much, if any, guidance. Surgeons developed a retinue of methods of their own. Numbing the area in question with ice, cold water, or snow was performed at least as far back as Hippocrates, but appears to have been entirely forgotten about or neglected for a stupefyingly long period. There's a 500-year span between the 11th century and the 16th, during which no mention is made of this method in the literature whatsoever. There are several nostrums and quaffs in the historical record that seem to refer to general anesthetics, but each of them is at least a little suspect. For instance, in the ancient Egyptian medical document known as the Ebers Papyrus, there are several recipes for things like anesthetics, but they seem to actually be describing alcohol, nightshade, and perhaps opium. Likewise, the Sushruta Samhita contains several recipes which appear to be mixtures of alcohol, wolf's bane, and marijuana. In China, reports of a workable general anesthetic date back as far as the 3rd century BC. The most famous version is known as Mefeisan, and was synthesized, in theory, by a surgeon named Hua To. According to the records of Three Kingdoms, Hua To's Mefeisan was so effective that he was able to resection a patient's intestines while they were under its effects. This seems unlikely, given what we know of what was available to Hua To, basically opium, hashish, ginseng, and various herbal roots and flowers. Even if Mefeisan did work as the records describe, Hua To burned all of his recipes before he was executed by a hated warlord he had declined to treat. Several philosophers and priests in the Islamic Golden Age, most notably Ibn Sina, also describe things vaguely approaching anesthetic, but again, they most likely refer to mixtures of opiates and THC. Meanwhile, in England, a tonic known as dwale is mentioned by numerous historians, physicians, and poets like Middleton and Shakespeare. Keats even refers to the dwale in his Ode to the Nightingale in the 19th century. What dwale actually was is uncertain. The best bet is that it comprised a range of herbal tonics, which ran the gamut from useless lettuce seed oil up through worse than useless drams of hemlock. In 1784, the influential British surgeon John Hunter began compressing the nerves of patients' arms and legs with tourniquets before performing amputations. That was the closest thing to progress anybody had come up with in several hundred years, and so became widely adopted. Henry Hill Hickman, another English physician working a little later than Hunter, pioneered the use of gas for anesthesia. Unfortunately, the gas he chose to use was carbon dioxide, which didn't create insensibility so much as apoxia. It was all the same to Hickman, who deprived numerous animals of oxygen before removing their limbs and rosily reported that the blacked-out creatures made no protest. At about the same time, the influential and quite silly ideas of Franz Mesmer were sweeping the world, and the supposedly pseudo-hypnotic powers of animal magnetism, phony as they were, proved such a popular port in a storm that whole mesmeric hospitals opened up across England and America. At least mesmerism had the decency to be useless, though. In the first decades of the 1800s, two much worse alternatives grew in popularity. In Yankee America, among the Quakers, surgeons turned to sapping patients over the head, unconscious. While in England, King George IV's personal surgeon, James Wardrop, pioneered an even lousier idea. Wardrop was attempting to remove a tumor from the face of a young woman, but found that even the slightest touch of the scalpel to her face sent her, for some reason, into insuppressible hysterics. The solution Wardrop riddled out to this shrieking conundrum wasn't especially clever. It was the sort of answer one might have expected from any top medical mind in the 1820s. Exsanguination. He bled his patient until she was too weak to scream, which hopefully meant she was also too weak to feel the pain. In any event, it prevented her from fighting back, so Wardrop called it a success, and soon his method took off and became all the rage. But medical practitioners saw a great danger with any state of stupor, whether it was achieved by leeches, liquor, or mallet. Damn, thought I had an alliteration going there. The mortality rate for surgery was high. So high, just unthinkably high. Having a conscious patient was terrible. Just you wait, because we're going to talk about how terrible. But at least when a patient was awake, you knew they weren't dead. You could get feedback from them, even express feedback, asking questions that they might answer between their hideous baying. It's not as if surgeons had access to BPM or blood pressure or anything, really. Today, medical ethicists talk about a patient being their own best advocate. However true that is now, it was doubly so 200 years ago. So, sure, you could spend a day with a mesmerist in the lead-up to surgery, if you liked. Take some laudanum, down a bottle of Jack. Any of that might help on the margins. But the reality was that surgery was going to come with an unthinkable amount of pain. And most policies and procedures were centered around working with, rather than against, that reality. For instance, if you've ever seen a really old hospital, like pre-1850s old, you might have noticed it had a tall tower, usually above the center of the building, away from the wings where most patients were kept. Hospitals in the 18th and 19th centuries were some of the tallest buildings around, right behind churches and clock towers. The central tower of a hospital, though, had a purpose opposite that of Big Ben. It was supposed to be isolated and obscure, not attention-grabbing, and you weren't supposed to be able to hear the calls that came from within it, because they were the screams of the operating theaters, which were so bone-chilling that it was an actual physical hazard to have sick people listening to them. There was a lot of discussion about how to restrain patients, whether it was best to have large men holding them down, or leather straps. Or maybe it was best to build a sort of cage around the patient, or perhaps a wooden box with a hole only so large as to expose the part that needed cutting. Another issue was how long to wait between telling a person they needed surgery and giving them the surgery. Everyone agreed it was a tough interval. People experienced a kind of madness about it. So, did they need more time to prepare? Or was it best to rip the band-aid right off? What all parties could agree on was that it was best to not have surgery at all. As much as it could be avoided, it should be. A surgeon couldn't begrudge the Georges-Louis Leclercs of the world. Their fears were valid. Surgeons were advised not to talk or write in detail about the gory details so as not to drive away people who might need their horrible care. But it didn't take a world-class 18th century natural philosopher to know which way the nature blew. Anyway, even if most surgeons themselves tried to keep relatively tight-lipped, there were plenty of other people to spread the word. Even though surgeries were far more gruesome than public executions, they were still nearly as public, conducted typically in theaters in which fellow surgeons, doctors, medical students, or anyone, really, might attend. Although you've really got to wonder about somebody who'd show up for fun. Patients themselves sometimes talked about or wrote about their experiences. Not as frequently as you'd think, though, because many were so traumatized that it took years for them to just be able to think about their surgeries, by themselves, in their minds. When they finally opened up, what they had to say was terrifying beyond imagination. So, let's take a little break before we get into it, huh?
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, Matt, did you know that wombats poop cubes?
Nope, never heard that before.
Did you know the unicorn is the national animal of Scotland, Ken?
I didn't know, nor do I care.
Neil, did you know that Liechtenstein is the only doubly landlocked country in Europe?
Jeff, isn't that an American pop artist?
Well, actually, it's both. If you want to learn things like that and more, join us each week on Triviality, a pub trivia-style game show podcast where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Listen in each week to answer general knowledge trivia alongside exciting guests from around the world.
And we're here too.
Join us every Tuesday for new hour-long episodes of Triviality, plus tons of extra theme content on everything from The Office and Lord of the Rings to science and geography.
And sometimes we even do sports.
Find us on all your preferred podcast apps and take part in the fun of playing bar trivia without the need to wear pants.
Real mature, Jeff.
Forget it, Neil. It's Triviality.
When it comes to surgery, in the mid-1840s or before, there are essentially four kinds of stories. The first and most common type is that of Buffon's bladder stones, the operations that were not performed. Of these, Buffon's is a mild version. His stones were frightfully painful, to be sure, but at least they were invisible and didn't otherwise impede his comings and goings. And they probably didn't kill him, either. That makes Buffon among the lucky ones. Many people, facing a choice between gangrenous waste or cancerous demise and surgery, chose to die, and die in pain and fear. Or else, told they needed surgery to live, they went home and took their own lives, a course of action so common that nearly any surgeon of the age knew such a patient. Because they figured there was, in that fatal course, somehow less pain and fear than going under the knife. And then there were the deformities, of all conceivable shapes and stripes, that could have been easily excised, but were instead born unhappily beneath masks and sacks and sheets, creating an underclass of ghastly untouchables to be at best pitied, more frequently avoided. It wasn't uncommon, in the not-so-distant past, to see people carrying around their own growths and goiters, in their hands, in slings, in wheelbarrows, in wagons, pained, hobbled, and marred, when a simple but unthinkable flip of a scalpel may have released them, at a cost too high, measured in down payments of agony and the long-term compound interest of nightmares. That is the first type of story. The second type of surgical story relates to those who were, for whatever reason, convinced temporarily to accept an operation. Maybe their prognosis was so severe that it superseded the fear of the knife. Or the throbbing suffering reached such a height that they couldn't imagine surgery to be worse. Or else they may have been convinced by the medical team that it wouldn't be that bad and weren't given much time to consider their options. Doctors contemplating the state of surgery in the 18th and early 19th centuries invariably compare the lives of their patients to those of convicts awaiting execution. The fear was like a yeast, eating at them, growing, expanding, and expelling belching foulness and pressure. It was best to move quickly. A patient's consent should be greeted enthusiastically and hastily before it had a chance to erode. Erosion happened rapidly, after all. Even the most steely, hardened, and motivated patient was bound to lose their nerve on the long walk to the operating theater, or at first sight of it. They were dark and dungeon-esque locales, dressed with macabre medical artifacts, bleached skeletons, fetuses under glass, bits of ancient mummies or toothy tumors floating in jars. The surgical chair was no more comforting, with leather restraints or chains or a team of burly attendants tasked with holding you down. The men in the viewing areas, barely discernible, but looking down on you with a mixture of fascination, revulsion, and fear. The surgeon himself might have been the biggest red flag on the whole scene. He'd have been dressed in a thick, black coat to hide the blood. It wouldn't have worked. Because no one had much of any idea about hygiene, the surgeon's coat was never washed. There seems to have been some pride taken in how much viscera one absorbed, a sign that the man beneath the thick, crinkly, blood-caked vestments was a proper veteran. The instruments, too, would have been tarnished with the remainders of those who sat in the chair before you. Only their handles were cleaned, so as not to dirty the surgeon's gentlemanly hands. What defines the second type of story is that at some point in the proceedings, in the waiting room, on the walk, at the entrance of the theater, in the chair, the patient flinches and runs. Orderlies and others regularly had to give chase, had to subdue their charges, who suddenly became violent, like a dog with its leg in a trap, when faced with the reality of what they'd agreed to. Then there is the third type of story, which is defined by silence. The people who went through a surgery and never spoke of it again. Most people who experienced an operation fell into this group. If they didn't die from infection or come away with some great injury which impaired their communications, they were often so tormented by their experience that they simply refused to relate it. Other times, the experience broke them in ways that a pre-psychological world struggled to understand. The most infamous example of this third type of story is Abigail Adams Smith, daughter to President John Adams and older sister to President John Quincy Adams. When Abigail was 46, she discovered a lump in her breast, and after consultation with her doctor, Founding Father Benjamin Rush, it was decided she needed a mastectomy. The procedure was performed by a team of the best surgeons in America, headed up by Dr. John Warren, one of the founders of Harvard Medical School, and a guy whose name you might try to remember for later. Warren conducted the operation at the Adams family home in Quincy, Massachusetts. It took 25 minutes to remove the breast, and a further hour to dress the wound and cauterize it with a red-hot iron spatula. Over that time, all of those who were seated in the room to comfort her, her daughter, her husband, her mother, met their limit and had to turn away. But Abigail, impossibly, remained stoic and silent from beginning to end. That silence persisted for the next 2 years. And we might not have any idea of what Abigail Adams Smith experienced at all if her cancer had not returned then in early 1813. Faced with the prospect of another operation or else certain death, Abigail chose death. She returned again to the family home with only her family and a load of opium for comfort. Whenever a member of the grotesque Society of Surgery Survivors attempted to describe the experience to the unadmitted, they had to acknowledge the impossibility of the task. There were no similes sufficient, no description commensurate, no metaphor profound enough to convey what they had gone through. A man who had been shot in war or had an arm crushed in a factory machine might explain that however foul the wound, the treatment eclipsed it. But this gave only a hint of what lay behind the clubhouse door. It was barely a line drawing. Two accounts of surgery tried to at least paint a watercolor, one from a chemist and the other an author. The chemist was Dr. George Wilson, professor of technology at the University of Edinburgh and the director of the Industrial Museum of Scotland. He provided a letter of his experience anonymously to his physician and friend, Sir James Simpson. It begins, "Several years ago, I was required to prepare on a very short warning for the loss of a limb by amputation. I at once agreed to submit to the operation, but asked a week to prepare for it, not with the slightest expectation that the disease would take a favorable turn in the interval, or that the anticipated horrors of the operation would become less appalling by reflection upon them, but simply because it was so probable that the operation would be followed by a fatal issue that I wished to prepare for death and what lies beyond it, whilst my faculties were clear and my emotions were comparatively undisturbed. For I knew well that if the operation were speedily followed by death, I should be in a condition during the interval in the last degree unfavorable to making preparation for the great change. The operation was a more tedious one than some which involve much greater mutilation. It necessitated cruel cutting through inflamed and morbidly sensitive parts and could not be dispatched by a few swift strokes of the knife. Of the agony it occasioned, I will say nothing. Suffering so great as I underwent cannot be expressed in words, and thus, fortunately, cannot be recalled. The particular pangs are now forgotten, but the black whirlwind of emotion, the horror of great darkness, and the sense of desertion by God and man bordering close upon despair, which swept through my mind and overwhelmed my heart, I can never forget, however gladly I would do so. Only the wish to save others some of my sufferings makes me deliberately recall and confess the anguish and humiliation of such a personal experience, nor can I find language more sober or familiar than that I have used to express feelings which, happily for us all, are too rare as matters of general experience to have been shaped into household words. During the operation, in spite of the pain it occasioned, my senses were preternaturally acute, as I have been told they generally are in patients in such circumstances. I watched all that the surgeons did with a fascinated intensity. I still recall with unwelcome vividness the spreading out of the instruments, the twisting of the tourniquet, the first incision, the fingering of the sawed bone, the sponge pressed on the flap, the tying of the blood vessels, the stitching of the skin, and the bloody dismembered limb lying on the floor. Those are not pleasant remembrances. Yeah, no shit! For a long time they haunted me, and even now they are easily resuscitated, and though they cannot bring back the suffering attending the events which gave them a place in my memory, they can occasion a suffering of their own, and be the cause of a disquiet which favors neither mental nor bodily health. The letter reads like a warning from beyond the grave, which is practically what it was, and ends with a powerful choice for the medical field, that they must either do away with pain or else with surgery altogether. However harrowing Wilson's tale was, though, it pales in comparison to that of the author, playwright, and diarist Frances Fanny Burney. Burney's novels inspired Jane Austen, and her comedies inspired William Makepeace Thackeray, but it's her letters and diaries that have most interested historians, particularly a letter written to her sister Esther, describing her own mastectomy, which she underwent in Paris within 6 months of Abigail Adams Smith. It was almost a year before Burney was able to write Esther about the operation, and there's little sign she ever talked about it with anyone else in her family, husband and children included.
When the dreadful steel was plunged into the breast, cutting through veins, arteries, flesh, nerves, I needed no injunctions not to restrain my cries. I began a scream that lasted intermittently during the whole time of the incision, and I almost marvel that it rings not in my ears still, so excruciating was the agony. When the wound was made and the instrument withdrawn, the pain seemed undiminished, for the air that suddenly rushed into those delicate parts felt like a mass of minute but sharp and forked poignards that were tearing the edges of the wound. But when again I felt the instrument, describing a curve, cutting against the grain, if I may say so, while the flesh resisted in a manner so forcible as to oppose and tire the hand of the operator, who was forced to change from the right to the left, then, indeed, I thought I must have expired. I attempted no more to open my eyes. They felt as if hermetically shut and so firmly closed that the eyelids seemed indented into the cheeks. The instrument, the second time withdrawn, I concluded the operation over. Oh no! Presently the terrible cutting was renewed, and worse than ever. To separate the bottom, the foundation of this dreadful gland from the parts to which it adhered, again all description would be baffled, yet again all was not over. Dr. Larry rested but his own hand and, oh heaven, I then felt the knife rattling against the breastbone, scraping it. This performed while I yet remained in utterly speechless torture. I heard the voice of Mr. Larry, all others guarded a dead silence, in a tone nearly tragic, desire everyone present to pronounce if anything more remained to be done. The general voice was yes, but the finger of Mr. Dubois, which I literally felt elevated over the wound, though I saw nothing, and though he touched nothing, so indescribably sensitive was the spot, pointed to some further requisition, and again began the scraping. And after this, Dr. Moreau thought he discerned a peccant atom, fragments of diseased breast tissue, and still, Mr. Dubois demanded atom after atom. My dearest Esther, not for days, not for weeks, but for months, I could not speak of this terrible business without nearly again going through it. I could not think of it with impunity. I was sick. I was disordered by a single question. Even now, 9 months after it is over, I have a headache from going on with the account. And this miserable account, which I began 3 months ago at least, I dare not revise nor read. The recollection is still so painful.
Bernie's telling of her mastectomy is difficult to read, or I suppose in your case, listen to. But one thing that sticks out is her concern for her surgeons.
To conclude, the evil was so profound, the case so delicate, and the precautions necessary for preventing a return so numerous that the operation, including the treatment and the dressing, lasted 20 minutes. A time for sufferings so acute that was hardly supportable. However, I bore it with all the courage I could exert, and never moved, nor stopped them, nor resisted, nor remonstrated, nor spoke, except once or twice during the dressings to say, "Ah, sirs, how I pity you." For indeed, I was sensible to the feeling concern with which they all saw what I endured. When all was done, and they lifted me up that I might be put to bed, my strength was so totally annihilated that I was obliged to be carried, and could not even sustain my hands and arms, which hung as if I had been lifeless, while my face, as the nurse had told me, was utterly colorless. This removal made me open my eyes, and then I saw my good Dr. Larry, pale nearly as myself, his face streaked with blood, its expression depicting grief, apprehension, and almost horror.
See, there's this impression of pre-anesthetic surgeons that is one of professionalized sociopathy. Ruthless, uncaring psychos, happily chopping or sawing or cutting away, deaf to the blubbering screams of their victims. But Fanny Burney's case, and many others besides, provide a different picture. There are accounts of surgeons weeping through operations, taking breaks to vomit and wail. There were speeches given by prominent surgeons dreaming of a day when their job might be obsolete, when they would never again have to enter an operating theater. The theater was certainly the most obvious signifier that the horrors of surgery were visited, if not equally upon the operators, then at least not sparingly. Anyone who hoped to one day practice surgery himself had to sit in on a number of procedures. This was a difficult prerequisite, in part because surgeons of the day did everything they could to limit the number of surgeries, and their patients did a good bit of limiting them too. But if you were a medical student who was able to find an operation to sit in on, you might quickly learn that this trade, however high your marks and good your grades, was not actually for you. That is what a young Charles Darwin discovered. In 1826, as a student in Edinburgh, he attended two operations. One of them was conducted upon a child, and Darwin found the procedure so intolerable that he fled the stands. In his diary, he said that the case haunted him for years to come. It convinced him he was not to be a surgeon, which we can probably be glad about, huh? And virtually the same experience, a series of intolerable surgeries performed upon young women, moved another aspiring surgeon even further afield, to poetry. In a world without anesthetic, John Keats chose instead to write about nightingales. With so many young surgeons turned away, so many older surgeons broken down, so many patients running from their care or suffering the consequences of it, you might expect that there was a race for a solution, for a substance to ease the pain and make surgical medicine more practicable. But you would be wrong. Very wrong. Not even wrong. What makes everything you've just heard even more unthinkable than you're already unthinking it is one utterly baffling fact. At the time that Fanny Burney and Abigail Adams Smith underwent their mastectomies, and Darwin and Keats flew from their medical training, and the Comte de Buffon resolved to suffer the pain of dozens of kidney stones, there was already a practical anesthetic in existence. Not one, actually, or even two, but three. Three chemicals well up to the task of rendering patients insensible to pain. Each of them were well known. Each of them were relatively easy to formulate. One of them was fairly new, but another had been discovered more than 600 years ago. And all of them had already been used on humans. Indeed, they were being used on humans at the exact same time that all the victims of surgery so needlessly suffered. There was no secret about this, no conspiracy or plot, no conniving pharmaceutical industry holding the world hostage or anything like that. It's just that, somehow, nobody had ever thought to use these relatively well-understood drugs to do the one thing it made sense to use them for. Instead, while surgeons butchered away at screaming patients on one side of town, on the other side, the drugs that could solve the problem were being used to get totally fucked up. And that is next time on Comfortably Numb, Part 2. Music for this episode provided by Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. A very special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. Particularly, a special thanks are owed to Jimbo Muskrat, Andrew Ballard, Major Trouble, Timothy Chaleco, and Wesley Armstrong, all of whom signed up before they even knew that we are now caring for a newborn. If you want to help put food in my child's mouth, you can head over to patreon.com/theconstant and sign up now. You'll get new episodes early and ad-free, as well as monthly bonus content for your trouble. Until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, where Daniel Hale Williams performed the first successful open-heart surgery in 1893 without general anesthesia, this has been The Constant.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.